comments. It's our weekly look back at the political 7 days that was. And there's really one story dominating. And to join me to discuss it, of course, is my lovely co-host, Emma Bunnell. How are you, Emma?
I'm very well, Charlotte. How are you?
I'm good, actually. Yeah, I've had, it's been quite a good week, all things considered. Lots of stuff going on. How about you?
Yeah, same. Nothing major to report. Been to the theatre a lot, which is lovely.
Naturally.
Naturally,
my darling. Well, we've had a bit of political theatre this week north of the border, because Nicola Sturgeon surprised us all and decided to do her best Jacinda Ardern impression and call it a day. It's a huge moment for both UK politics, Scottish politics. You might even make the case it's quite a big deal in kind of EU politics and British EU relations, given how Nicola Sturgeon has approached Brexit and so on. That there's quite a lot to unpack here. What was your first takeaway from it, Emma?
Well, I'm in shock originally. I mean, I'd been saying, and I think I said when we discussed the gender recognition reform.
Yeah, we do need to come back to that, because I think that is a part of this story.
Yeah, that I thought that she was slightly panicked and on her way, not out, but on a, you know, she peaked. But I didn't expect it to unravel this quickly. I'm not saying that it's all down to that one issue. It's not. But I think there has been quite a quick unravelling of her leadership. I mean, let's not pretend that she's not still the most popular politician in Scotland.
She's arguably the most popular politician in the UK. If you poll individually, she always polls significantly higher than any of her rivals in leadership positions.
Yes, indeed. And so, but she has, you know, her popularity and that of her party has dipped quite significantly. And I think that she's getting out while the getting out is good, but that it happened so quickly is, you know, quite unusual in politics. Very unusual in the SNP. You know, she's been either leader or deputy leader for 16 years. Yep. And what was always the case, it seemed, was that there was a, you know, the next step was lined up in the SNP. That's what they were quite good at. That there isn't an obvious successor, and that she's decided not to intervene in the succession, at least publicly, is really quite extraordinary.
Yes. Yeah, because when Salmond, I mean, I remember very clearly, we'll come on to who might replace her in a minute, but I remember very clearly that night of the Scottish referendum, of the independence referendum, watching on BBC. And there was a moment, wasn't there, where it was very clear that the independence campaign had been defeated.
Yeah.
And I just remember this image of, and therefore Alex Salmond was going to have to go. And I just remember this moment of Nicola Sturgeon swooshing down the stairs with an unmoving, perfect blow dry and a perfectly fitted suit. And you just sort of knew what was coming. She knew what was coming. Her moment at the top table had arrived, and she has certainly taken, she'd been the first minister for 8 years, leader of the SNP for 8 years, yeah, as you say, at the top table of the SNP for 16, you know, mentored by Alex Salmond, for better or for worse. Is there, and yeah, we'll come on to who might succeed her in a minute, but let's talk about this unraveling, because go back and listen to our episode on the row that erupted over gender recognition and the changes Nicola Sturgeon, the SNP, wanted to make to that, because I think that is one part of the story. We don't need to repeat our conversation there, but I think it is one part of the story.
Yeah.
How contentious and fraught, and I suspect personally draining on Sturgeon, dealing with that became. I think
in particular, for a couple of days, it felt like the imposition of the Section 35 order by the Sunak government, by the UK government, was going to be a boon to the SNP, and that just didn't materialise. And I think this is the fight that she had chosen to pick to demonstrate the dominance of UK government over Holyrood. But because the proposals weren't that popular in Scotland, actually, a lot of Scottish people, many of whom would support independence more widely, were actually not concerned about Sunak's about this Section 35 order, and therefore it just didn't become the constitutional fight she was looking for.
I think that's right. I think, talking of constitutional fights, I get the impression, again, look, I live in London. I don't know the intricate details of Scottish politics. I'm not going to pretend to. But it feels to me like this, her pushing for the next general election to be a de facto referendum, hasn't quite gained the momentum she hoped it would. It feels to me that actually there's a bit of a narrative coming out of Scotland, not dissimilar in some ways to the one we have here about the Conservative government, where people are going, you've been in power a long time. What have you actually done for it with it that makes my life better?
Yeah.
I think that's starting to filter through, isn't it? And like the obsession with independence is not quite the same as what it was.
Well, I would separate a sense of being pro-independence with a sense that we must have a referendum now.
Or that the general election must be that referendum.
Or that the general election must be essentially a de facto referendum. Nicola Sturgeon, I think, is an exceptionally good politician.
She is.
But her long-term reputation as First Minister will not bear well, because actually during that time there has not been an awful lot done and an awful lot has gone wrong. If, for example, your passion in Scotland is education, all of those markers have gone backwards.
Health,
same. She
drug
had
use, the issues personal, with drug use within Scotland are huge.
I mean, before we move on to that, in terms of health, she had a great personal profile during COVID. But actually, the Scottish health system is suffering many of the same problems as the UK health system, despite some of the interventions that they've made. The drug death scandal is an absolute scandal and underreported. And then there's transport. I heard this morning that it is costing them as much to buy two ferries. And these are really, really important. I've actually been to the Isle of Arran on the Calmac ferry. And if that ferry doesn't run, those islands are completely cut off, sometimes weeks, even months on end. That's really important. But it's costing them more to buy those two ferries than it costs to build the whole of the Parliament in Holyrood.
Good
That's
grief.
A complete scandal.
That's crazy. Yeah, that is correct. And we'll come on in a bit, I think, to who might, I don't like to use the word benefit, but what the political fallout from that will be. But let's just finish dealing with actually the point of exit. And first of all, COVID, because it kind of relates to what I want to say. There was a point, wasn't there, during the worst days of the pandemic where Nicola Sturgeon was completely dominant. And I think that goes to your point about her being a savvy politician. Now, I have no doubt she was genuinely concerned about the health and well-being of Scottish people and trying to stop the spread of COVID-19. I have absolutely no doubt about her sincerity of that. But she also played the politics, didn't she? She realised that people were comfortable with lockdowns and restrictions and being told what to do by, certainly at the beginning, you know, all sorts of other stuff has played out since, but she was pretty clear. She got that assessment right. And it seems like she understood that Scottish people would actually in some ways tolerate even tighter restrictions at different points than we had in the UK. And she also was on the airwaves at different points more than the UK government and tried to, and I think this was intentional politicking as well as doing what she thought was right, make herself the sort of leader and that she was out in front of what the UK government was doing.
Well, I think
that plays to her style of politics, doesn't it?
Yeah, the comparison that she managed to forge was between her decisive action and Boris's dithering.
Yes.
And that, you know, that really played to her strengths, because she is very much seen as a decisive politician. Sometimes that has gone against her, certainly in recent times, the my way or the highway thing.
Yep.
But certainly when nations need leaders, they need them to be decisive, not dithering. And she was very much taking that role on, far more so than Johnson did.
I think that's right. And this brings me to really my key point of what we need to talk about in terms of her resignation, which is I do think, I made a slight dig about Jacinda Ardern at the beginning because the similarities are obvious. Mm. But we do have to appreciate the toll that political office takes on people. We sit here as people that chat about it. We're not having to make the decision. Look, ultimately, what you and I do is a luxury. We can we can talk, we can take the piss, we can, we can say, wish they'd done this, that or the other, but we don't have to make those big decisions. And being in the position where you do genuinely does take a toll, particularly at the highest levels. And I think it's interesting that both Jacinda Ardern and Nicola Sturgeon, as women, have been the ones to understand when their time is up. Yeah. And perhaps we, they didn't do that male macho thing of toughing it out and, trying to stick with it through the end until someone shows them the door and it's all gone wrong. And maybe political leaders will learn that actually it's much better to bow out on your own terms because this stuff is difficult. You can't do it forever. No human being could. And actually it's better to end as close to the top of your game. You'll laugh at my comparison because you know I'm going to make it, but it's a bit like football managers. And sometimes, Emma, you can't see Emma's face, but she's like, what's a football manager? sometimes managers at football clubs do really well and they're at the kind of peak of their cycle and they're like, keep going for a season or two too long. And you're like, maybe you should have left some or two. And I think obviously it matters much more in politics. She says, unconvinced. But,
I think that's right.
The ability to know when you should leave is an important one, isn't it? And these women have shown they do know how to do that.
I mean, to get to the top, you have to believe that only you can do that job.
Yes. Yes. People underestimate that outside politics, don't they?
They do. But it's absolutely the case. You have to believe that ferociously and for years. So how do you then get to the point where you've got the job, having believed that only you can do it, and then it's time to end? That's a really hard thing to do emotionally, intellectually. And I do think, because we're also down on politicians all the time, that we do underestimate how hard that shift is to make.
Yeah, it certainly is. I was thinking, was Theresa May, Liz Truss was a whole different kettle of fish, so let's ignore that. But Theresa May obviously was a female leader. Yes, she did know when her time was up, but it was also coerced as well. And she never, it's a slightly different comparison, but again, didn't try that macho thing of holding on for too long, did she? Even Theresa May.
She
knew her time was up.
There were several times where her time was nearly up and then it wasn't.
Yes. It wasn't her exit, it wasn't her own.
And I would be slightly conscious of not gendering this too much because Thatcher had to be forced out.
Yes, indeed.
I don't think there's some unique female quality necessarily. I think that the pressure on female politicians is different. Mm. And she has been subject to the most appalling misogynistic abuse.
Without doubt.
Which will add an additional toll that male politicians will never understand. Again, I think I don't want to over imbue the magical feminine. She is.
Oh, I don't know. Indulge me.
But she is, she's a politician. She's made a lot of mistakes along the way. She's made some very good calls along the way. It's when the latter start to recede and the former start to proceed that you really kind of
need to realise your time is up.
Realise that your time is up. Not everyone does realise it. So kudos to her for getting the fact that that's happened. Although that she's done it so swiftly is going to raise questions about what else is going on.
Mm. Around like donations, aren't there, to the SNP? There's a bit of that stuff swirling around.
Yeah, there is an investigation into a donation made by her husband, who is also the chief executive of the SNP.
Naturally.
Which is in itself
keep it in the family.
A donation made by him and undeclared for quite some time, and what she did and didn't know, and when she didn't know it.
Yeah, how would you know what over £100,000 from your husband has gone. I mean, how would you possibly know that?
I mean, I just can't imagine that well. I mean, to be fair, when I was married, we kept our finances pretty separate. But I would know if my husband had 100 grand, and I'd probably also know if he then didn't have it.
You might notice it in some way or the other. Yeah, it just anyway, that will all come out in the wash again. Look, her savviness is what has played through the whole time, and she's got out before any of this stuff could be. She has left on her own terms. Whatever one thinks of all her decisions, the ability to leave on your own terms, I think, is quite impressive. And you're obviously right about not over-gendering these things. Of course you're right. But I can't think of many male politicians that have exited in this way, with perhaps the exception of Tony Blair, who knew his time was up and orchestrated.
I mean, that memo about, you know, Tony bowing out to these crowds of adulation is all a bit very,
it's very Blair, isn't it?
Buttock clenching. Yeah. Although on the other, I mean, to be in a much smaller measure, I found some of her speech a bit less graceful than Jacinda.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because the word I and me was used rather a lot, wasn't it?
And not simply in terms of I want to go and have a life and hang out with my niece and nephew, which was cute and I liked that bit. And that's perfectly fair. Politicians are human beings. But it was all about I've always been the best person to lead and I still am, but I'm going to go. And even though it's going to hurt everybody that I go, I'm going to go anyway. And I just thought that's a bit graceless and really not very helpful to your party or cause.
It sort of started with, I know there'll be people who are very upset about this decision.
Yeah.
That is true, because she does have some very sort of...
That is absolutely true, but a graceful politician leaves it unsaid.
Yeah, I mean, it was all a bit much, wasn't it? And again, look, she's been at the top table of her politics for best part of 20 years, hasn't she, really, one way or the other? And has been this very dominant figure. Look, the SNP have had these two dominant figures for decades. Yeah. First Salmond and then her. And I can see why, if you're in that bubble, you can think this world revolves around you. But graceless is exactly the word to describe large parts of that statement. I was a bit like, maybe you want to say some thank yous?
Yeah, And you know, talk about the wider issues. Yeah. Rather than why you're the only person to lead on them. And I think this is part of the problem. The SNP lost the referendum, or the pro-independence side lost the referendum in 2014, at least in part because they hadn't done clear bits of homework about the economics and some of the things that
they thought they could click their fingers and keep the pound, or that the euro would magically appear, or, you know, didn't make sense.
And they still haven't. And this is the problem. They've become the referendum party and not the independence party. And until they do that homework, I'm not sure that they are going to get what they want, even if they manage to get that referendum.
And it also has to be convincing. I remember very clearly there was a point, it kept coming up, didn't it, during the referendum. Every time a pro-independence politician was interviewed on TV, the journalist would say, so what currency will an independent Scotland have? And they said, well, we'll keep the pound. And all the UK government had to do would say, no, you won't. Says who?
We're not tagging our currency to your tiny and possibly failing oil-dependent state.
Yeah. Well, of course, the next question that we have to deal with is who will replace Nicola Sturgeon. But before we do that, I'd quite quickly like to return to the horror of Turkey and Syria and the consequences of the earthquake. Because last week we highlighted the work that the Disasters Emergency Committee are doing, and also the White Helmets. I can't watch some of the news reports where you see this devastation. I don't know, maybe you're less cowardly than
me,
I'm Emma.
The same. I really am. I find it so hard.
It's utterly distressing. And, you know, we know that some people are still being pulled out, have still been pulled out the rubble alive, which is quite extraordinary. So if you feel willing and able to support the work of either the Disasters Emergency Committee or the White Helmets, who were at some point, correct me if I'm wrong, basically the only people who could get into parts of Syria, weren't they, the White Helmets?
They because they were already there. And there were complications because they were working in the areas of rebel strength as well as other areas.
Yeah, a sad strike. So if you feel able to donate, please head to dec.org.uk or whitehelmets.org, and you can make contributions on both those websites to those causes. The numbers are too horrific. So, and of course, we're now going to be at the stage where also those who have somehow survived will need housing, clean water, food, and you know, this is just the beginning of what's going on. So if you feel able to donate, please do. Let's go to the more paltry in some ways, well, after talking about that talk of succession planning and kind of internal politics, because the SNP's internal politics looks, the factionism of Labour look like a nice little tea party, doesn't it, sometimes? But
it's fascinating, not... because yes and no, because they've all, I mean, they usually vote like the Borg. Rebellion in the SNP is almost unheard of. That, I think, three MSPs rebelled against the gender recognition was so unheard of. It was notable.
Well, and if you look
in... rebelling in any other parties is just Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Westminster bloc as well, bloc is the right word, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, the Westminster Bloc did recently have a putsch. So they ousted Ian Blackford.
Yeah. Thank goodness.
Yeah. And brought in, oh God.
There you go. Yes, that one.
His name, who is not a Sturgeon ally.
No, Mari Black is the deputy leader in Westminster, isn't she, I believe?
Yes, I think she is more of an ally of Nicola Sturgeon. Yeah. But the guy who's running it, Stephen something, I think, very much not so, and that again was just another indicator that she might have been losing her grip.
Stephen Flynn MP.
Thank you. I knew it was Stephen. At least I got that right.
Yeah. So we have to then talk about who will be the nominations are. They'll be decided on March the 27th who her Nicola Sturgeon's successor is. I believe nominations are open now.
Yes.
I don't think at the time we're recording, no one's actually officially declared, as far as I'm aware. But there are.
I think he hasn't declared, but he's pre-declared.
Hamza Yousef, he is on the list. He's the health minister.
John Swinney's ruled himself out.
Who was Nicola Sturgeon's deputy.
Yeah.
So Hamza Yousef, quite an impressive, younger, up-and-coming SNP politician. He is the health secretary in Scotland.
Well, that's going to be a poison chalice, isn't it?
Arguably so, yes. Quite a lot of fertile ground to attack him on if he becomes the leader, but he is... as I say, one of the newer generation, quite an impressive figure whenever I've seen him. The name that is going around a lot is Kate Forbes, who is the finance secretary in Scotland. Just come back from maternity leave. I'm really
not yet returned from maternity leave.
Right. I'm really sorry to do this, Emma, but would you like to know how old she is?
Oh, isn't she like 12 or something? She's on maternity leave, but you know what I mean?
She's 32. I mean, it's absolutely... that should automatically rule you out. If you're younger than Emma or I, you're gone.
Absolutely. That's getting harder and harder to maintain.
Happy birthday for next week.
Thank you.
There's, of course, Angus Robertson, who's led the Westminster Group. Mm. Quite a prominent figure. People will have seen him. Someone who I can't claim to have heard of at all, Mary McCallan, she's an MSP for Clydesdale. She's 30 as well. I mean, for goodness sake.
There is such a thing as passing on to the next generation, but that next generation doesn't have to be that next.
Yeah, I think that's where Hamza Yousef probably has quite a good claim to things. There's also Neil Gray, who's an MP for Airdrie and now is in Hollywood. John Swinney, as you say, has ruled himself out, but he was the Deputy First Minister. So slightly
There's
surprising.
Ash Reagan, who resigned over the Gender Recognition Reform
Act.
Community Safety Minister.
Yep. And in that vein, there's obviously Joanna Cherry, who might throw her name into the ring, who's obviously done a lot of work in that area. So, there's quite a few names floating around. I can't pretend to know who's going to get this. I don't know the intricacies of the party anywhere near well enough. All I know is that I saw one set of polling that had...
Yeah, the name recognition's appalling.
Right. It had don't know at about, I think it was over 60%.
69%, I think it was.
Yeah, and then everyone else was in like 5, 6, 7%.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a huge, huge thing for whoever wins this to overcome.
Yeah, and there are also a lot of what is understood again from London is how much of Scottish politics and SNP politics as well, more particularly because it's so focused on Scotland, is actually sectarian.
Right.
And so one thing that will really be highlighted if Kate Forbes does run is her membership of the Free Presbyterian Church.
She's quite religious, isn't she?
She's very religious, very, very religiously conservative. The We Frees, as they're known, broke from the church over various sort of social conservative things. And so she, that will, in a party that has long struggled with whether it's socially progressive or socially conservative, that will put her in a very particular camp.
Yes, that's SNP under Sturgeon has very clearly put itself as the progressive but independence combination. You might like some of the left Labour stuff, but you support independence and you're not a Green. So that's where you become SNP. It will be very interesting to see how that plays out. You're absolutely right. And also this thing of like, will the next general election be a de facto referendum? I understand there's a little bit of internal dispute and wrangling within the SNP.
Yeah, there was a sense that she might not win that at the special conference that was supposed to happen in mid-March, but has now been indefinitely postponed, which was going to decide whether that was the right strategy or not.
Yeah, so that will obviously be another very big internal debate. And no doubt all the candidates who officially declare will get asked about that as this process goes on. I think we also have to discuss, we've spent a lot of time.
Just to say, I think it would be a real shame for the SNP, for Scottish Parliament, for Scottish politics, and particularly for the Scottish people, if the discussion about who gets to lead them and therefore be First Minister boils down simply to the Gender Recognition Reform Act, and independence, because there are so many other things that that parliament does and has power over. And it would be a lacking of journalism. It would be a lacking of scrutiny if they are not asked about those issues properly.
Yes. Well, we've mentioned health, all the things you mentioned before, health, drug deaths, the economy, of course. Everything is there's huge transport, there's huge issues, and you're absolutely right that should be much more focused. And yeah, I do worry that on the journalism side, it'll be much easier to ask about those things than you know, some of the stuff
we have an immediacy problem in journalism. Correct. So, yeah, those are the things that you would highlight. But you really, to be First Minister, you've got to have a grip on those other things too. And really important,
as you rightly say. Scottish people deserve those issues being properly tackled. That was the point of giving a devolved government those powers. Let's talk actually not about the SNP, because it's not now, I don't think, a given that the SNP sweeps the board either in Westminster elections or maybe even Holyrood elections. I think the sands are shifting a bit, but of course we will come to a Westminster election first, probably. I think now this must be from a chance for Labour to make reclaim some of the seats in Scotland it has been wiped out of over this time. It's a really important moment, I think. And of course, the SNP, a lot of the time when Labour was in its kind of total meltdown phase, basically made themselves the not the Tories option.
Yes.
And I don't think that's as prevalent anymore.
I think I said in that last in the last podcast that we talked about Scottish politics, part of the reason that Nicola Sturgeon was going so hell for leather on some of these issues was that sense that the Tories may be out of power soon. Mm. And it's much, much easier for the SNP to run against a UK Tory government than a UK Labour government. It may well be the case that a slightly diminished SNP coming along at the same time as a significantly strengthened Scottish Labour Party. I would say Anas Sarwar is one of the best leaders that Scottish Labour's had for a long time.
Yeah, again, I think there's a slight, as there always is, a slight name recognition problem, but he does, whenever you get to see clips of him, seem quite a calm and sensible and quite credible.
Yeah, and
guy.
I would say his name recognition in Scotland is significantly better than
it might be in Britain,
which is exactly the right way round.
Sure.
In a moment of serendipity, Scottish Labour actually have their conference this weekend. So they can really use this moment to take the reins of the conversation and say, look, while the SNP is squabbling amongst themselves, we're going to make a big and generous offer to Scotland.
I don't think I'm exaggerating too much. I saw Jim Murphy, the former Scottish Labour leader, tweet this. And I don't think I'm exaggerating too much to say this could be the difference. If things go as we kind of think they're going, this could be the difference between either small majority or even a minority Labour government or a majority Labour government.
It could be. I mean, if things are going the way they are currently, Labour's going to win weird seats in England that it wouldn't normally expect, which would make up for the cross-the-board losses in Scotland that they've been experiencing in the last few elections. But nobody...
these things tend to compress.
..about that happening, and polls may well tighten. We just don't know.
They tend to, as you get closer to an election.
They do, but we always... I mean... The thing about politics is it always happens this way until it doesn't. So,
sure.
But I think, I mean, there are two reasons that Labour want to win in Scotland. Firstly, if you want to be the party of the UK, having seats in all parts of the UK is really important. But secondly, Labour want to win MSPs in Scotland. They want to represent the Scottish people who have Labour values. And I think it's vital that the Labour Party doesn't see Scotland as a route to Westminster elections. It sees Scotland as a valuable thing in and of itself, a prize on its own. And I would be really cautious about anyone other than Anna Sawa talking about winning in Scotland. Beyond the fact that we are a unionist party, Keir Starmer should play this carefully, not triumphantly.
Yeah, I haven't heard much from him yet. But yes, it is a bit of a delicate balance, isn't it? Because I think one of the things that led left-leaning people from Labour to the SNP was there was a bit of presumptiveness, wasn't there? That people in Scotland felt that Labour was just already taking their vote for granted, was sort of weighing their votes, not counting them. And that, I think, eventually counted against the Labour Party.
Both weighing their votes, not counting them, and also treating Scottish Labour as a branch office rather than an important political instrument on its own.
Yeah, but, you know, we've lost these two people who've had a stranglehold on Scottish politics for two decades and now gone. I suspect it's not actually the last time we've heard from Nicola Sturgeon.
I'm sure she'll have other things that she'll want to do.
I suspect she'll pop up at key campaign moments.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a huge shifting sound. That's why we spent the whole show talking about it. Emma, thanks so much. That's been a great chat. And where can people keep up with you?
I'm on Twitter, although less and less often at the moment. Elon Musk has broken my addiction. It's amazing. If only could get off my smoking. So I'm on Twitter, @EmmaBurnell_. And I also have a newsletter that you can sign up to called Hard Thinking on the Soft Left on Substack.
I'm very good at it too, if you want to know about the internal machinations of Labour and the left. I'm @CharlotteAHenry on Twitter. I write the Edition newsletter on Substack, which is all about tech and the media and the crossover of that with culture and politics. So I hope you join me over there. And we will see you next week.